Well, I almost refuse to believe that the Lollapalooza Music Festival is 25 years old this weekend. The 25th anniversary Lollapalooza gets started today. Grant Park, Chicago, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Radiohead, J. Cole, Lana Del Rey. Kathy Dunbar tells me that she has been to a Lollapalooza. How long ago?
20 years ago?
20
years.
Remember who played? No. That proves you were there. This year, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Radiohead, Lana Del Rey. The first lineup featured Nine Inch Nails, Susie and the Banshees, Living Color, and Jane's Addiction, 1991. I can scarcely believe that. 25 years old. Our first two guests today are both involved in a couple of Lansing's most newsworthy issues. Carol Wood and Kathy Dunbar are members of the Lansing City Council. Both serve on the council's Public Safety Committee. That committee's working on improving security and conditions at a challenged public housing complex, South Washington Park Apartments. It continues toiling away on a marijuana ordinance for the city. To hear their views on both of those, we welcome back Carol Wood and Kathy Dunbar. I'm glad you're here today.
Thank you.
Carol, you've referred to a regression to the status quo at South Washington Park, and there are challenges there involving security, violence, conditions have been substandard. As specifically as possible, what's the Public Safety Committee trying to get done here with regard to South Washington Park?
We want to see an improved living conditions for those that are living there, especially the most vulnerable people that are in that facility. We have seniors, we have those with disabilities, we have single parents, and when you're dealing with from bed bugs to unclean facilities to the fact that you're afraid to come in and out of your apartment, those are huge issues. And we heard this over and over again at the public safety meetings from tenants who felt that they were not getting the responses that they needed from the management of that complex.
And there was a shooting there.
Absolutely.
In March, a young man died there. There are various stakeholders here. Obviously, there are the residents. There's the city council representing those residents. There's the Bernero administration. Of course, there's the Lansing Housing Commission, which oversees the building. Tony Baltimore, who is the president of the board of the Housing Commission, was on this program Monday, and he suggested that the commission's not on the same page as the city council. Is that the case?
Yeah, I would say that is absolutely the case. Again, we have approached the commission numerous times to look at improvements. We'll see an improvement for a short period of time, and then after a while it regresses back, and we have some of the same things, security, tenants being victimized, and, you know, this just isn't acceptable. Do I understand that they're challenged with their finances? Absolutely. But I think that when you realize that this is an ongoing problem that hasn't gone away, you've got to look out of the box and come up with some solutions. And I know we can turn to Kathy Dunbar. She came up with some solutions in our meeting, especially dealing with bed bugs and some of those things, that it just sort of rolled off their backs, and we haven't seen any improvements.
Let's bring Kathy into the conversation here, though. I mean, generally, is what Carol has said, are you in general agreement with that assessment?
Yeah, it was very frustrating to listen to the scenario. I deal with a lot of populations that have limited income, and when finances are the barrier, you have to think of other ways to fix problems that don't involve money. And one of the things that we had talked about with the bedbug situation is that one of the treatments for linens and things is extreme heat and taking them to a laundromat. And the suggestion had been, you know, that they take everything that they have to a laundromat, wash it on high heat, dry it on high heat. And then a preventative is to dry things on high heat. And so I said, is it possible that you could get commercial dryers, commercial washers and dryers, and just keep them on site so that residents that don't have transportation, who aren't going to haul their bedding on their backs to the local laundromat all the time when there's an infestation, you know, could treat and preventatively, you know, have their clothing heated on site.
Is there movement on that?
I don't think there is. I don't. And I suggested a couple of companies that might have used equipment, and so yeah, I'm looking at different ways for them to help themselves on site without, as I know HUD doesn't have the money, and I know that we've had HUD in to discuss that, but there are different solutions that folks should be looking for.
Patricia Baines, like Antoni Baltimore, were both on the program on Monday. She as well suggested that funding is a real hurdle here. To what extent can security and conditions be improved without more funding? It sounds like that's where you're at. You're trying to be as creative with limited funding as you possibly can.
Well, again, if you've got, and let's go back to the infestation of bed bugs, if you have to continuously pay to have that treated and done and dealt with versus buying a commercial dryer that might end up helping solve it or reduce the amount of times that you're having to pay for that, you know, that's a savings. They need to look at those issues. Currently, we have a community police officer that is at that facility that's working hard. But is that, in essence, their paid security? Yes, they've installed cameras. Yes, you know, that you've got staff that are there during the day. But do you then look at the staff and having them come in at different hours so that they're there when you have some of those problems? I mean, limited dollars, yes, but how are you creative with those dollars?
Carol Wood and Kathy Dunbar both serve on the Public Safety Committee for the Lansing City Council. We're talking about the challenges at South Washington Park Apartments. We're going to talk about efforts at a marijuana ordinance in Lansing in just a few minutes. Let's move beyond the bed bugs, though. What about safety at South Washington Park?
Well,
yeah,
there
we're
are a number
both looking
of safety
at each
issues.
Other.
You know, there are tenants that have other people living with them that have created problems there. Yes, they're going through the eviction process to try to weed out those that are problematic. How good are they doing with their background checks when they are putting people in? When there are complaints, how are they addressing those complaints in a timely manner? Are they taking those complaints seriously? If you have a door, a security door that's been broken over and over and over again, and there's no, and you're not fixing it properly, you know, those are all security issues. Those are all where there are issues. We had listened to people that, especially the elderly, that had problems with people pounding on their doors and threatening them because they had gone to staff over issues, loud parties and drug dealings in the apartments and things like that. And, you know, those are things that whether you live in a vertical neighborhood or horizontal neighborhood have to be dealt with. And as property owners, as people that manage that property, you've got to be on top of it. We're not asking anything different than what we would be asking of any landlord in the city of Lansing.
Who amongst the residents and the Housing Commission, are there people that are resenting the efforts of the city council to resolve these issues? Or
I don't know of any residents who are resentful of this. I will say this, the challenge, Carol mentioned that it's a vertical housing complex. We don't build those anymore. They are problematic in and of themselves with the systematic way that folks are housed. And I hate using that term housed, but that is.
How many floors are we talking about here?
There's 188 units.
Yeah. It's six?
Yeah.
Five or six. And then what you have is you have limited access. You have the first floor as your way in and out, and then you have all of these units above. So there is, you know, they have to pass through other areas to get in and out. The security door issue, definitely. I mean, sometimes it's propped. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes somebody that's living with a resident props the door. So there's an issue there. Sometimes the doors are broken. But that is, if you know that there is a limited access in and out, and those are the doors that are propped, as opposed to having to monitor every floor, you monitor that first floor and those doors where there's access. I don't know. It's really difficult for me after having been involved with Arbor Point years ago.
Right.
We did this huge citizen engagement over there, and the property managers had a completely different idea about how to solve the problems at Arbor Point. This is 12 years ago than the residents did. And the residents came up with they literally wanted us to paint parking spots on the ground so that they knew who lived in what apartment and could identify if somebody was there that didn't belong there. It took a gallon of paint and a bunch of stencils, and we did it in a weekend.
Do you see a way forward here? What is the way forward as far as you're concerned, Carol?
Well, I think it's listening. It's listening to the residents, and it's also listening to the concerns that council is hearing. Oftentimes, you will have people that will come to us that might not come to management. And Patricia and Pat need to, or Patricia and Tony need to understand that we're there to help. We're not there to just find fault. And we're willing to do that if we can all come to the table and, again, respect each other and respect what's out there.
We want to move on to the marijuana ordinance here. Your committee is gradually making its way through another draft of a city ordinance. Kathy Dunbar, what do you think so far of the document here? I'm under the impression City Attorney Jim Smirtka is by and large responsible for this. Am I right about that or not?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
What do you make of the document he's put together so far? Just your general impressions.
It is a different document than we had before. It definitely gives more consideration to the actual MMA, if I can say
Michigan
that correctly.
Michigan Medical Marijuana Act.
Yes. It's definitely a balancing act because we need to make sure that what we are saying within this ordinance comports with what voters approved and what the state vaguely put together in the act, and that we don't restrict anything that's allowable, but also, you know, take into consideration what's going on in our neighborhoods and what's going on in our corridors.
Carol, your quick thoughts, impressions here. Is the document you're looking at now sound?
I believe it's more comprehensive than what we've had in the past. I think when we're looking at it, and we're going to be seeing two documents, this one that deals with the commercial aspects, along with one that will be seen from Jim in the future that deals with in neighborhoods, with caregivers in neighborhoods. So these are two different issues that we'll be working on. There are a number of criteria in here that I think are important. We heard during these hearings, we've heard from dispensary owners, from caregivers, from patients that have all said, 90% of them said that we need a licensing and regulation. How we get there, there's a variety of different opinions.
The number of shops or provisioning centers in Lansing is often referred to as somewhere in the 60 or 70 range. For a lot of people, that's too many. My question is, the aim of an ordinance to close down some of the 60 to 70 businesses that are apparently already out there operating?
That is not the aim of this ordinance as it's written. It is a licensing ordinance. In fact, I talked with several of the attorneys that have been working on it, Mark Dodson included. There are definitely legal issues with we don't cap licenses on any other business in town.
Would you like to see fewer, though?
Can we legally see fewer is the question.
And your opinion of that is no?
I do not believe what we do is through the licensing, it will weed them out. Just arbitrarily saying you have to close down is not going to be a legal answer.
Carol, I think you've made clear you'd like to see fewer of these, and some number of Lansing residents would like to see lots fewer of these.
Absolutely.
Well.
But I think what we're talking about is competent businesses that are following the Michigan Marijuana Act and that are acting responsible. We have places that are allowing patients to smoke in those places. This ordinance would prohibit that. There's a number of business criteria that are part of this licensing ordinance to make sure that they meet certain requirements. Will that close some down? Absolutely. It's no different with any other licensing aspect that has a list of requirements. If you don't meet them, you're not going to end up with a license.
A big piece of this seems to be where these businesses operate as well, in commercial corridors like Michigan Avenue or in the neighborhoods. Is it preferable to concentrate these in one area or the other? Is this an either-or situation, or is this more of the balancing act? you were talking about, Kathy.
Well, I think that you're talking about two different operations. You have the home providers who are individual caregivers that grow and or distribute, you know, from their home with their five patients, or you have the dispensaries. The dispensaries aren't allowed in residential areas. They're not allowed in those areas to begin with. But
caregivers are.
But caregivers are.
Yeah.
And we are not allowed to know where they are.
Carol, you've expressed some impatience at how long an ordinance is taking. The timeline just seems to shift further and further into the future. What's your best guess in terms of when the council might realistically vote on an ordinance?
We're working very hard to have meetings almost every Friday on this ordinance to get through it. This will also have to go before the Planning Commission because it deals with zoning. And so the Planning Commission will have to make a recommendation. My goal would try to have something by the end of September, 1st of October at the very latest. Because we do have a comprehensive ordinance right now, I believe it's just tweaking some of the things that are in it.
Carol Wood, Kathy Dunbar, both serve on the Public Safety Committee of the Lansing City Council. We've been talking about the challenges at South Washington Park Apartments and the challenges on putting together a marijuana ordinance for the city.
Marijuana?
Kathy,
you singing that?
Kathy, Carol, I belong at Lollapalooza, don't
there you
I?
Go.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Coming up on Current State, Democrats wrap up their national convention tonight in Philadelphia. We'll talk with reporter Kathy Gray of the Detroit Free Press about the Michigan delegation and the nomination of Hillary Clinton. That's coming up. Well, the area around Houghton Lake and Higgins Lake in Michigan's northern lower peninsula is renowned for its natural beauty and recreational opportunities. The woods and waterways of the Pier Marquette and Ausable State Forests are a destination for many who enjoy the great outdoors here in Michigan. It's also a region acclaimed for an endangered yet beloved bird. 50 years ago, the Kirtland's warbler was in danger of extinction. But a series of conservation efforts is bringing the small bird back to healthier numbers. Current State's Kevin Lavery set off to find this striking bird in its unique forest habitat.
No one really knows how long the brilliant little yellow-breasted bird that Jared Kirtland first identified in 1851 has lived in Michigan. But the Michigan DNR's Keith Kintai can tell you when the Kirtland's warbler first showed up here. In this stretch of jack pine forest near the Crawford-Kalkaska County line, oil pump jacks chug along in diesel-powered perpetuity.
This became a dedicated Kirtland's warbler management area because of a wildfire.
The sparks that flew from a pipeline worker's welding torch touched off a blaze that consumed more than 4,200 acres. The smoke from the Fletcher Road fire could be seen 20 miles away.
It started to the south of where we're standing and burned to the northeast. There was jack pine here that burned. It receded after the fire, and Kirtland's warbler occupied this area in the 70s, and so we've continued to manage it.
Fire is key to the Kirtland's warbler's life cycle. This bird, which breeds almost exclusively in Michigan, seeks out young jack pines for bugs and berries. It nests on the ground in the shade of its branches. The Kirtland's warbler prefers short, young jack pines that are only a few years old. Taller, more mature trees are more susceptible to fire. U.S. Forest Service biologist Phil Huber says it's their very demise that triggers the creation of the warbler's habitat.
The species has what is called serotonous cones that are opened when heated by fire. And when a fire burns through a jack pine stand, those cones open. And over a period of weeks or months after the fire, the seeds disperse from the cones, and then literally millions of new seedlings start as a result of the fire burning through that area. So the fire scarifies the soil, removes all competing vegetation, new seed falls to the ground, and then we have new seedlings. And in about 6 to 8 years, we have habitat for Kirtland's warblers once again.
Phil Huber, Keith Kintai, and I have come to this site along Fletcher Road where the 68 wildfire gave rise to today's wildlife. Joining us on our field trip is Chris Mensing. He's a biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Like me, Chris has driven 150 miles from East Lansing to spot a Kirtland's warbler. If that's going to happen at all, this is the place.
We have a lot of Kirtland's warblers, relatively. You know, we're still talking about a very rare species, only 2,300, 2,400 males in existence. So we're not talking about a large population, but where we've done the habitat management, we're finding the warblers show up pretty much anywhere where we're creating habitat.
But so far, we're not seeing or hearing them as we trudge through the sand that marks the outwash plains that are characteristic of this part of Michigan. It's a cool, cloudy morning with just a hint of drizzle. But the weather is not the determining factor for the solitude. Nesting season, the time when singing males are most vocal, is long over. Nesting is also the time when the Kirtland's warbler is most vulnerable to manipulation. Not by man, but by a fellow flyer, the cowbird. Again, Chris Mensing.
Cowbird is an obligate nest parasite. And what that means is a cowbird will not build a nest. It relies on other birds' nests to lay a cowbird egg in that host bird's nest, and the host birds will raise a cowbird chick as its own. Most birds have figured this out, and there's a balance that they've worked out just naturally, that some cowbird chicks survive, some host bird chicks survive, things go on. Unfortunately for Kirtland's warbler, they do not have any defenses against cowbird parasitism. So as a cowbird will lay its egg in a Kirtland's warbler nest, the Kirtland's warblers will raise the cowbird chick at the expense of its own.
Mensing takes us to a large steel cage in a clearing off the path. About 6 feet wide and roughly 8 feet tall, this is a cowbird trap. Cowbirds are very social, so conservation officials use live males and females as decoys to lure their peers into the cages, which are well stocked with food and water. Mensing says this is a humane way to give the Kirtland's warbler the peace and quiet it needs to take care of its own.
We trap lately about 1,500 to 2,000 cowbirds a year out of these areas, and it works. We've actually have some researchers from the Smithsonian doing this is the second year of a 3-year study to look at what the effects of cowbird parasitism is in these areas when you remove the cowbird traps. And what we're finding out is that these traps work remarkably well. Parasitism rates are effectively zero.
Back on the sandy path, we've still had no luck. Chris Mensing has an idea, but he's a little reluctant to carry it out. He's got a recording of a Kirtland's warbler on his phone. Mensing says though it's an accessible way for bird watchers to spot their prize, it really should be done sparingly.
What you're doing is you're altering their natural behavior. It's taking their attention away from their feeding and then coming to look at you. And so we have concerns that, you know, at a large enough scale, that could be an issue, with, especially for some of these really critically endangered species that need all the help they can get.
Chris fires up his phone and waits for the reply. His chance pays off. Soon a male appears in front of us, partially concealed in the pines. The Kirtland's warbler is a species on its way back up. It's a success story in Michigan, a place that's learned the hard lessons of the 19th century lumber boom that nearly decimated the bird. In this century, the timber industry's improved harvesting techniques are vital to the warbler's survival. Today, loggers are partners, not predators. The Kirtland's warbler is most at home in a mix of dense forest and open spaces. For every acre of jack pine planted here, the U.S. Forest Service deliberately cleared 1/4-acre tracts it calls plantations. They've worked well, but biologist Phil Huber says foresters are now starting to turn to a more natural approach.
This was a way that we produced Kirtland warbler habitat in a very effective manner for the past 40 years. We're starting to look at moving away from this and trying to mimic Mother Nature better, looking at wildfires and how the jack pines are distributed within those wildfires, and then looking at different methods that we might employ to mimic those better rather than just creating these solid plantations. And then by doing that, we'll probably benefit a lot of other species as well, and not just the Kirtland's warbler.
As its recovery continues, the Kirtland's warbler remains a federally endangered species. Its resurgence is a point of pride for many Michiganders who feel it should supersede the American robin as the official state bird. An annual festival celebrates the Kirtland's warbler each June, and the official mascot of Kirtland Community College in Roscommon is the firebird. Like the mythical phoenix, the Kirtland's warbler is rising from the ashes of near extinction. But its survival requires more than just the hard work of its champions in Michigan. The Kirtland's warbler spends its winters in the Bahamas, so it's up to local officials there to do just as much to protect its favorite tropical getaway far from the icy north that welcomes home its favorite firebird in the spring. For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And coming up on Current State, another Harry Potter book is coming out this weekend with midnight parties planned all around the world. We'll learn how Schuler Books in Okemos is using the newest expansion to the world of J.K. Rowling to help a girls' school in Kenya. That story coming up on Current State. We've got a pop-up story coming up here from our last outing. Keep in mind, tonight's is our next at Valley Court Park, scheduled for 7 o'clock this evening. Our theme is The Call of the Wild. Hope you can join us for that, or consider it at least. The Democratic National Convention concludes this evening in Philadelphia. Yesterday, here on Current State, we spoke with a couple of delegates from Michigan. The busy schedule today is highlighted for the Michigan delegation by a session with Bernie Sanders. Current State Scott Pohl talked with Detroit Free Press reporter Kathleen Gray early this morning. What's she covering today, Scott?
Well, as you might expect, Mark, she's spending the morning at that breakfast with Senator Sanders. And not surprisingly, the activity in Philadelphia isn't just about the campaign for president. Kathleen Gray, welcome to Current State.
Hey, Scott, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for talking with us this morning. Now, yesterday on the show, we talked with two members of the Michigan delegation, Hillary Clinton supporter Chris Savage and Bernie Sanders delegate Mark Lachey. While they backed different candidates, they seemed to be on the same page moving forward. From the floor this week, the level of contention between the two camps seems to have been ebbing and flowing. What have you observed in general and amongst the Michigan delegation? You described the delegation as pretty contentious. What's been going on?
Well, there is breakfast every morning for the Michigan delegation, and those breakfasts have been pretty contentious. There's a handful or maybe close, 6 to 12 people who are really hardcore Bernie Sanders supporters, and they want their voices heard and have been very vocal and very upset at the way this whole thing has shaken out. There was some interruption of some speakers. There was a point where they, the chair of the Michigan Democratic Party finally just took the microphone away in order to try to maintain some level of control. It's been pretty contentious, but, I think that people are starting to come around. People have been texting me pictures of Bernie supporters and Hillary supporters standing together arm in arm. And so I think perhaps President Obama's speech last night and Joe Biden's speech and Michael Bloomberg's speech may have gone a long way to try to unify these folks.
As we were watching on TV last night, we saw some of that on TV with people standing together, holding a sign that said, "I was with Bernie, now I'm with her."
Mm-hmm. Right. And, I think that some of the Bernie Sanders supporters just needed that time and needed the opportunity to kind of vent their frustrations with the system. Their frustrations with the email leaks from the Democratic National Committee, that showed a bias towards Hillary Clinton. I think that they just needed some time to get there. And I think it's happening. We'll see. The Michigan delegation's breakfast starts shortly. And Bernie Sanders is coming to speak to the Michigan delegation. And we'll see if he does enough to kind of unruffle those feathers that have been ruffled in the past week.
One thing I'm curious about is these sessions you've described that the Michigan delegation takes part in. We see what's going on the floor on TV all night long, but we see less of these meetings that you've described. Aside from the presidential politics, I'm curious about other things that might be going on there, like, for instance, jockeying for position to run for governor in 2018, that sort of thing. Is there a lot of that going on?
Absolutely. You've got both Dan Kildee and Gretchen Whitmer, who are the two most prominent people who have expressed an interest in running for governor in 2018, and both of them are here. And Gretchen sponsored one of the breakfasts, the first breakfast on Monday morning, and was a speaker. Dan Kildee spoke one other day, and he also hosted a lunch for the delegates. Now, the lunch for the delegates was not open to the media, so we didn't get to hear that message. But when he did talk to the delegates that we did see, he talked a lot about Flint. And I think if you just changed a couple of the words there, you might have been hearing a campaign speech from both of them for 2018. Now, although they say that, gosh, this is all about 2016, it's not about 2018. But, you know, they acknowledge that both of them are looking at it very seriously.
Mike Duggan's name has been bandied about as well as a possible candidate for governor. Has he been involved in that sort of jockeying?
He hosted a reception on Sunday night for delegates, and he continues to say, no, I am absolutely not running. I'm running for re-election as mayor of Detroit next year, and stop asking me. But I think that there are a lot of Democrats who would love to see him on a gubernatorial ticket. He's done such a great job in Detroit, and I think that a lot of people think that if he was on the ticket, it would be a slam dunk for Democrats. But he continues to say, no, 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 don't put my name out there. So we'll see what the next year brings.
Kathleen Gray is in Philadelphia covering the Michigan delegation to the Democratic National Convention. There were a couple of speakers yesterday at the main convention from Michigan, including Mike Duggan of Detroit.
I was born in Detroit, and for decades I've watched our city lose tens of thousands of jobs. I'm 58 years old, and the population of Detroit has declined every single year I've been alive. But that's changing now, as our city's recovery is fueled by a renewed spirit of unity and a commitment to creating a comeback that includes all Detroiters.
And Flint Mayor Karen Weaver.
Today, the help we need from our federal government to start rebuilding our drinking water infrastructure still sits blocked in the Republican-controlled U.S. Congress. I am a voice for Flint, and we need your help.
Tell us about the impact you may have seen, not just amongst the Michigan delegation, but how the other states around you responded to their messages yesterday.
Well, it was very enthusiastic. The Flint water crisis has kind of taken on a national tinge, because there are so many cities out there that have problems with their water. And so I think that that was a message that a lot of states could relate to, a lot of cities could relate to. And as far as Mike Duggan goes, I mean, Detroit is a success story. And they went through bankruptcy, and, you know, he had a good line in there about, you know, that Donald Trump is somebody who knows a little bit about bankruptcy, but Detroit is only going to go through one. And, you know, Donald Trump has had a number of his businesses have had a number of bankruptcies. So I think that people responded very well to that. It was a good line for him.
One final question. We're talking on Thursday morning, the last day of the Democratic National Convention. Aside from Hillary Clinton's acceptance speech tonight, what's on tap today that we'll be reading about at freep.com later today and in the Free Press tomorrow?
Well, we've got Jennifer Granholm is going to be speaking tonight as well. So we'll certainly be there for that. Hillary Clinton is also speaking. And, you know, there are a few things that that we're working on that you'll have to tune back into freep.com to check out in the morning.
And I expect some coverage of the talk that Bernie Sanders gives to the Michigan delegation this morning will appear
absolutely.
Midday,
yes.
Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, hopefully this morning we'll be doing that story and seeing how people are reacting to him and how what message he has for the delegates that are supporting him here.
Kathleen Gray covers politics for the Detroit Free Press. She is in Philadelphia covering the Michigan delegation to the Democratic National Convention. Kathleen, great talking with you. Thank you.
Well, thanks for having me.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
WKAR in Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. The next installment of the Harry Potter story, Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, is being released this weekend. As with the release of many other books, some stores have midnight release parties, including Schuler Books in Okemos. Current State's Jamie Paisley sat down with the person who's been prepping this weekend's festivities. Hi, Jamie.
Hey there. Her name is Emily Gaylor, and she's been tremendously busy, certainly, prepping for this event, which begins Saturday night at 9. You know, she even proudly showed me one of those banners that she's been working on that celebrates Hufflepuff pride. I'll give it to her, I guess. I'm not in that house, but that's fine, too.
Nice.
Another great thing about this Schuler Books Harry Potter release party is that a full 30% of the sales is going to the education of certain students, and I am not talking about those at Hogwarts.
Assembly Community Assistance is actually the charity that we're donating to, and Assembly Academy is their project, and it's a school to educate girls in the rural Iten area of Kenya. And it is a organization that's very near and dear to our hearts because it is the brainchild of one of our booksellers, who's been a bookseller since before I worked there. She's also a professor, and it's just something she does on the side. And then on top of that, she also does this amazing work working on building this school to educate girls, a lot of girls in the rural areas of Kenya, for one reason or another. Whether it's obligations to home or community or different things, don't necessarily have that encouragement to go to school. So that's basically what this is about. They also do once a year take a trip and do different educational programs, put on workshops and stuff for kids in the Iten area as well. So she's actually just got back from that earlier this week.
Now, I know the donations that are going to the Academy. This is not the first event that Schuler Books has had that's part of the partnership that's been bringing money to raise them. But I believe, from what I've found online, usually it's about 20%. You're increasing that for the Harry Potter release party.
Well, I think the owners made this decision that both of the parties in the Grand Rapids area and in the Lansing area, they really wanted to really support something that was important. Will doing this like really fun thing. If you're going to get all these people out together for a common cause, it just makes sense to be able to pass along a little bit of it if you can. So that's what we're trying to do. Our focus is, you know, Harry Potter, the books, if you've read the series, which if you haven't, don't tell me. but the message of Harry Potter is, I think, at its heart about community. And so, bookstores at their heart are about community, and I think that that's why having this event be about helping a community is, you know, important. So Andrea, who is one of the founders of Cymbale, is a dear part of our community, and she is working really hard to you know, better another community, and we want to help her do that, and, you know, so it's important to us.
We're speaking with Emily Gaylor of Schuler Books about the upcoming Harry Potter release party that's coming at Schuler Books in the Meridian Mall in Okemos. Going to be from 9 until midnight for those that are brave enough to to weather the crowds. And a certain percentage of every part of the ticket that's sold goes to the Cymbeline Academy Fund in Kenya to help the girls' school that's there. Now, when it comes to the book, this is, if people that have read the book, this is a very different entry. It's not quite prose. What is the format of Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, part one and two?
Yeah, it's actually a script from a play that is being produced right now. It's a continuation of the story. My understanding, of course, is... limited because they have an embargo on that book. We can't even open the boxes until that night.
Well, that answers that question. There's no sneak preview for anybody staff.
No, you have to sign a waiver that says you won't even break the seal on any of the boxes, that you won't post a picture on social media, that you won't do anything like that, which I think is important, but I think also Harry Potter fans are unique in that they don't want to ruin it for anyone. You know, like they want, like, if I know someone hasn't read Harry Potter, I want them to read it. I want them to experience it. I don't want to ruin a moment of it for them. So I think that that's something special. We're all kind of waiting. I don't want it to be ruined. I know most people I know don't want it to be ruined. They just want to read it and enjoy it. So it's really cool that people are kind of keeping it under wraps. And
even J.K. Rowling has put out a video and a hashtag of keep the secret. Mm-hmm. So don't, people that go to the play, that read the script for the play, they don't tell anybody either.
Yes. Well, and that's when the series, the first 7 books came out. That was, I mean, I remember when the last book came out, everybody kind of racing to read it because you didn't want anything to be spoiled.
So when it comes to Saturday night at Schuler Books, 9 until midnight, what are the things that if people come, whether they are parents and they bring their children or they just want to come on their own, which I'm certain will be happening as well, what can people expect at the Schuler Books in Okemos?
Okay, well, if you have bought a ticket for the event, you'll get a bag and it'll have everything you need for the party in it. It's going to have a map of activities and it'll have some galleons to spend on the activity stations, information about Cymbeline, and some other little goodies that we've thrown in there. If you haven't bought a ticket, you can come and you can just buy a couple galleons and participate in activities or just look around or just enjoy being around other Harry Potter fans. We're going to have a design your own button station or magnet station. We're going to have Professor Trelawney reading tea leaves. We will have a Gringotts where you can buy your galleons. We'll have a Weasley Wizard Wheezes shop, and Ollivander's where you can come and get a wand. So yeah, there's going to be lots of things, cupcakes for Harry Potter's birthday. There's going to be lots of different little things going on. Of course, there'll be little hidden decorations around the store that'll be worked into the scavenger hunt, and just like a lot of Harry Potter loving.
The Harry Potter release party for Harry Potter and the Cursed Child comes up this Saturday at Schuler Books in Okemos. More information you can find online at
schulerbooks.com.
Emily, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
Well, Current State's next pop-up stories is tonight in East Lansing. If you haven't attended one of our live storytelling events yet, here's a story from our last event at Lansing's Allen Marketplace. The theme then was Putting Down Roots. Esperanza Rubio Torres tells the story of her family's roots and how she has come to feel at home in more than one place.
My roots are fresh and ancient. They are vast and varied. My maternal grandmother and grandfather were both born and raised in San Antonio, Texas. My grandmother bounced in and out of orphanages until the age of about 14 when she went to go live with her grandmother. And my grandfather was also raised in orphanages. In the 1940s, they came here to Lansing, Michigan. My grandmother landed first in St. John's, Michigan, where she worked in a vinegar factory. They did meet in the 40s, and they fell in love. They got married, and my mother was born here in 1947. My father was born and raised in Mexico from a mother and father from a farming community in the state of Guanajuato. My dad came to Lansing at the age of 35. He had very basic English skills. And amongst this quick and dirty summary of my physical roots, there was a child born in the 1980s on a cold mid-December day, and this is your humble servant here before you. My mother took me straight from the hospital to Torres Taco House on the north side. That was my grandma's restaurant, and she was desperate to see me, obviously, because hello. My first trip was to the restaurant and to my grandmother's loving arms, and I have many memories there. My first steps, my first solid foods, and actually my earliest memories there are of blatant child labor, cleaning tables, trying to sweep with a tiny broom that would get caught under the tables. And obviously I grew up here in Lansing, and I graduated from Eastern High School, Quakers, anybody? No? Just me. Oh, no. Okay. And actually, my junior and senior year English teacher was at Eastern when my mother graduated from there. So more roots. So let's talk about my reincarnation in all of my lives. In 2007, I moved down to Mexico, and I left the warm embrace of Michigan, but also the cold winter, and that was incredible. My parents retired to Mexico in 2003. And I was in desperate need of change, so I packed all of my bags, and I had all my luggage, and then I left pretty much everything here with my friend. And I went to Mexico, and I started practically from scratch with my parents. The cliff notes of my Mexican life. I worked as a teacher, then in IT. I was promoted to a finance department. I partied, laughed, learned about my personal feminism. I made lots of bad choices. I wore high heels. I learned a lot more Spanish, and I drank a lot of fresh orange juice. I ate a lot of tacos, and I lived a very colorful, carefree life. I learned about my culture. I found minute but incredible subtleties about my life that I can only attest to genetic memory. I lived a Mexican life that taught me about my Michigan life. I lived a Mexican life that jaded me a bit, roughed me up a bit. Ooh, bless you. Aged me a bit. But what I earned in general life lessons was well worth everything. Cities bigger than Lansing in developing countries are not for the faint of heart and are filled with lights that can guide you or that can blind you, depending on what you make of them. Many of my Michigan tribe came to visit me, bringing me things like perfume, mall-purchased antibacterial gels that I couldn't get in Mexico, and yes, quality dairy donuts. Manna from heaven. For the girl who is lax to lay down roots or to stay anywhere too long, my roots were two countries deep. To make a long story longer, I was laid off of my cushy finance job, the one with the gorgeous office and the majestic view of the city from the fifth floor. After a spectacular forced departure, I had a big party to celebrate my new unplanned vacation, and I came back to Lansing for the summer of 2013. And then I went back to Mexico. My bones were not prepared for that nasty winter many of you lived, the one with the 2 weeks of no electricity. No. Like I kind of felt that was coming, I had already secured a round-trip ticket, and I went right back to Mexico in October of 2013. Returning to Mexico, to those roots, I went to the school that gave me my first job in English school. After almost a year of thinking about my opportunities in Mexico, my education, and my life in general, I decided to come back to Lansing. My happiness, my static place, is some sort of Schrodinger's cat. Being back here in Lansing, I've been here almost 2 years again. Things are familiar, not always as shiny and warm as I remember them. Things feel nostalgic, a little bit dingy, and certainly not like they did when I left. I still don't have the heart to go down the street that my grandmother used to live on. Some of my favorite haunts are gone forever. And only last year did I learn that the north side of town where I grew up on was known as Taco Town, putting down roots. That said, I'm happy to be back in Lansing. I've connected with my old friends. I've made new friends that are getting married. They're buying houses. They're having babies, all of this fun stuff. And like I said, I returned in November of 2014, and sometimes we put down roots, and sometimes roots come to us because I was given a job at the same place that my mother retired from when she went to Mexico.
Storyteller Esperanza Rubio Torres at the Allen Marketplace last month with Current State. Our next pop-up stories is tonight at 7 o'clock, Valley Court Park in East Lansing. Our theme is The Call of the Wild. We've got a full lineup of storytellers set to go. We are keeping a close eye on the weather today. Storms could mean cancellation. We'll update our Facebook page accordingly. That is Pop-Up Stories Lansing. Otherwise, we hope to see you there. That's our show for today. Coming up Friday here on Current State, we'll look back and we will update July's biggest Michigan news stories on our Month in Review segment. Chad Livengood of the Detroit News joins me along with Paul Egan from the Detroit Free Press. Also, live music here in Studio S on a Live Music Friday. Singer-songwriter Matt Watroba joins us and performs, and we'll get to know Matt and hear his music tomorrow here on Current State. Hope you can join us. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Katie Cook directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and Drew Hill. The Current State podcast is always there, too, anywhere, anytime, at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast. Everything we do on the program ends up on the podcast, and it also ends up online, WKAR.org. Just follow the links to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us today. We'll be looking for you Friday and tonight at Pop-Up Stories in East Lansing. Have a great day.